Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast about politics, not the podcast about politics. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey Corey.
In this midweek shot, we're going to summarise the changes in Brexit policy announced by Labour and the Conservatives over the last couple of weeks. So let's do Theresa May's speech first. She is Prime Minister after all, at least in name. Theresa May was going to give her speech in Newcastle about 10 days ago, and she wasn't able to get to Newcastle because of the snow, so did her speech in London instead. And in terms of Theresa May not being able to get to her preferred destination because of forces outside of her control, it feels a bit of an apt metaphor for her Brexit position. In fairness to May, it was quite a sensible speech. There were some concessions to reality in there. There had been leaks from the Foreign Office that Boris Johnson was entertaining the prospect of a hard border between Britain and Ireland, but May scotched them and said it would be an open border. She also would have displeased people like Jacob Rees-Mogg and said that the European Court of Justice will have a role in Britain after Brexit. She also said that after Brexit, single market access would not be as good as it is for Britain at the moment. So there was a little bit of a reality check there that somehow actually Britain, its standard of living might be negatively affected in some way. May's criticism of the EU was fair. May said in that speech that the EU wants Britain to have the same regulatory standards as Norway, but receive the benefits of a Canada free trade deal. And even Ian Dunn has come out and said that actually May's criticism of the EU is quite fair. And if Ian Dunn thinks that Theresa May is making fair comment, it probably is. Problem is that Theresa May still isn't really choosing between trade and control, in that you either have complete control over your trade, like North Korea, or you have lots of trade which benefits your economy, and you've kind of got to choose. And Theresa May still isn't really doing that.
And that, fundamentally, is the issue that the government has to deal with. But the issue is the Conservative Party itself is still quite split on that issue. On the one side, you've got the European Reform Group, who are going to be leaning quite heavily towards control. On the other side, you've got your Anna Sowerbury's, your Dominic Graves, your Nicky Morgans, who are going to be leaning quite heavily on the trade side. And amidst all of those, you've probably actually got the vast bulk of Tory MPs who just want this debate to go away.
It's never going away, Steve.
No, I know, it's never going away. But yeah, those two groups, small though they are actually in number, I think the European Reform Group's about 50 people?
I think 62 signed the latest.
62 signed the latest thing, and there's even fewer actually on the Remain side.
I think about 11, maybe 11, 15?
Probably a few more than that actually when it comes down to it, so you're probably pushing up towards maybe 20. It's very small numbers actually in comparison, but they're both very, very loud, and they're both quite organised, which is causing ultimately the headache for the government. If one of those groups didn't exist or was a little bit less efficient, they would not have anywhere near as much problems as they are currently having.
It's a problem for Theresa May when her MPs also don't seem to be able to understand metaphors. Ian Duncan Smith, former Tory leader, obviously was in the House of Commons on the Commons debate on Brexit and said that doesn't the Prime Minister realise that cherries are there to be picked and cake is there to be eaten? And you realise that Ian Duncan Smith doesn't actually understand the concept of metaphors.
And they elected him leader.
They did, but for the very, very sensible reason that he wasn't Ken Clark, because imagine what a disaster that would have been.
I know, like Ken Clark actually in charge of the Conservatives, they'd probably be in fighting shape by now.
Actually, Britain would probably have joined the Euro.
And that is a fair point.
Anyway, enough of such idle speculations, listeners. In Theresa May's Florence speech, which of course you all remember, is probably seared into your brains from September, Theresa May came up with three baskets of regulations, which is essentially there are some rules that Britain will harmonise with the EU, will basically keep the same. There are some rules that we'll align. So we'll try and have the same status as EU regulations, but we'll try and achieve it in a slightly different way on goods. Now, there are some where we're going to try and diverge and have different regulations from the EU. And the one that's always mentioned is agriculture and fisheries. This is obviously, this is part of Michael Gove's grand plan to save small animals in recompense for destroying the nation's education system. Of course, the problem with that generally for Britain is that agriculture and fisheries is actually quite a small bit of Britain's economy compared to, you know, the 95% of it that is services, manufacturing, all that kind of stuff. Now, in the speech last week, Theresa May talked, she added a fourth basket, which are called creative solutions. Now, that sounds as desperate as it actually is, in that those are about trying to achieve something which has never ever been done before, which is trying to include services in the free trade deal. And as we keep banging on, listeners, the Canada trade deal that the EU and Theresa May and even Jeremy Corbyn talks about, well, the Canada free trade deal doesn't cover services. The other problem is that even before Theresa May had given her speech, the EU and Donald Tusk had already rejected the proposals that Theresa May was working on. So it feels to me like most of Theresa May's Brexit speeches, they're never really directed at the EU and trying to address their problems. It's all about trying to manage the dissent in the Tory party. Now, to that extent, it kind of worked, because you didn't have those two factions. You didn't have the European Reform Group or the Saboteur Mutineer Group. Both of them seemed relatively happy. No one really came out and criticised it one way or the other, which I suppose is good for Theresa May until the next time she has to make a decision about it in about 2 months' time.
Yeah. I think the one thing I would pick up on from what you've said there is the fact that the EU has basically rejected the stance that Theresa May has taken. You know, it isn't particularly surprising, but this is one of the points that I do think is actually overlooked an awful lot when it comes to criticising the government's position. That the EU has said, you know, we don't think this will work is fine and one thing, but these are negotiations. And the fact that the government's adopted a position which the EU doesn't like, well, that's kind of how this was always going to go. In an ideal world, you get all the benefits of single market access, all the benefits of the customs union without actually having to be members of either. That's clearly not possible, but you can still put forward ideas which are slightly pie in the sky at the initial kind of start points for negotiations, and then roll back. The problem we've got is that the government still doesn't know what it's doing and doesn't know what outcome it's looking for, which means it hasn't got an overall plan. Instead, it's just going forward with whatever it can get away with at the time.
Also added to that is the fact that the UK government also seems to be rolling back on some of the promises it made on the Irish border back in December, when I think our podcast was called "The Can's Been Kicked Down the Road, But How Far?" Well, actually, the answer to that seems to have been about 4 months. To answer your point of how could the government be in a position where they got the benefits of single market and customs union while not being a member of the EU? Well, they could do that either by being a member of the EEA or a member of EFTA, but the government has ruled that out for various reasons, and Theresa May explicitly ruled them out again in the Florence speech and in the speech in London about 10 days ago, which again to me makes absolutely no sense.
I think the position that the government should probably be taking is saying we will join EFTA, but at the same time, what we would look to do is, you know, negotiate a few other bits and pieces that would be slightly different on, say, fisheries and agriculture or whatever. Because that would then allow the image that the government knows what it wants, rather than this constant, we're not going to be a member of the customs union and we're not going to be a member of the single market, but also we're still going to try and push for all of these things, without which, you know, aren't necessarily going to be deliverable in any form. If there was a specific aim of EFTA plus, for an example, or EEA minus, that might actually be feasible. Because I think what the EU is lacking currently is any indication about what Britain wants. When you look at all of the documents and things that have been released by the EU, and you do a comparison of their negotiating position, and then you compare what's been released by the UK, it's quite startling how little has been released by the UK. By the virtue of not seemingly releasing those documents and by not seemingly coming up with those positions, they're just putting the ball into the EU's court because they've actually got preparation on their side. Whilst seemingly David Davis is just darting off all over Europe to do not very much.
Yeah, actually, maybe David Davis has all the papers he needs in excruciating detail. He just won't show them.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly what you've said is true on the Irish border, where the EU basically published a proposal because the British government didn't publish one. In terms of EFTA plus or EEA minus or what have you, well, actually, I believe I'm right in saying that being a member of the EEA would allow you to diverge in agriculture and fish, because mm-hmm. Norway and Iceland are basically in the EEA and not in the EU because they wanted control over the fishing. Certainly Iceland did. I cling to the maybe over-optimistic belief we'll end up in something like the EEA out of panic in March next year. On the other hand, the projections seem to be that if we were part of the EEA, that would lead to a 2% drop in GDP.
There is no outcome other than staying in the EU or staying in both the customs union and the single market, which will not lead to some kind of negative impact on GDP. That is, at the end of the day, the price that we pay for sovereignty, quote unquote. You know, I don't necessarily think it's a worthwhile trade-off, but 52% of the British public disagreed with me.
Will of the people, Steve. Talking of the will of the people, Jeremy Corbyn also gave a speech. And that doesn't really work as a segue, but we'll go with it. Now, this podcast, I suppose, has been quite sympathetic to Labour's Brexit dilemma, in that there was really no way in which you can please Labour's vote and membership and MPs, in that a lot of Labour voters voted Leave, a lot of Labour constituencies voted Leave, but its MPs overwhelmingly remain, its members overwhelmingly remain. Keir Starmer has been pushing, or it seems anyway, Corbyn very, very, very slowly towards a more remaining position. And if Theresa May's speech was about moving the Conservatives like two notches towards reality, Corbyn's speech seemed to be about moving Labour two notches towards Remain. And the big thing that was trailed in his speech was that Labour would want to be part of a customs union with the EU, as long as it could then have a say on future trade deals with the EU.
Again, dear listeners, not to be confused with the customs union, but a customs union.
Having criticised Labour's press operation in the past, we should take a moment to savour the fact that it was Barry Gardner, who's Shadow Trade Secretary, the member of the Shadow Cabinet, who has stuck his neck out and said that Britain should not be part of the customs union, that it would be harmful for Britain to be part of the customs union. It was that Barry Gardner who Labour sent out to do the early morning rounds on the day of Corbyn's speech to the breakfast TV shows, saying why staying in the customs union was such a good idea. We have been critical of you, Seamus Milne, but kudos for that one. I think it's two things, isn't it? One of them is trying to be a little bit more Remainian than the Conservatives to keep that current vote and keep Labour's coalition together. But also, Jeremy Corbyn's Brexit position doesn't necessarily seem to be based on any particular wider principle other than defeating the Tories. You saw that by the fact that Labour leavers like Dennis Skinner were happy to vote against the government on Brexit issues when it looked like the government would lose a vote. But also the fact there's now votes coming up on the customs union membership and a salary table and amendment that Britain should remain part of the customs union, that actually Corbyn's shifting Labour's position to reflect that wider parliamentary arithmetic too.
Yeah, it is quite interesting how Corbyn and his leadership are actually playing Brexit now. Before, everything was, as we've previously discussed, quite a bit of a muddle, out of necessity more than anything. Striking a specific position would have been potentially quite dangerous. It would have annoyed someone somewhere, and you know, the electoral coalition that Corbyn's built will only get you so far. And if you remove one of the legs from it, you know, the entire thing could come tumbling down. But as time's gone on, the position has evolved. Partially, I suspect this is down to the work of Keir Starmer, actually working with the leadership team to actually finesse the position into something that's workable, not just in terms of the politics, but in terms of actually being a decent policy in some form as well. But I think it just boils down to the fact that as the Tories continue to be defined in many ways by the lack of progress on Brexit, by the lack of seemingly being able to define what they want and be just be hitting hurdle after hurdle after hurdle, for an awful lot of Tory Remainers, it may very well be that come the next election, they could look at Corbyn, who has been much more clearer about what he wants, but not being, you know, so Remain as to ignore the will of the people. That might be a potentially a winning formula for Corbyn to try and win over a few more votes, because it's entirely possible that some of them may very well think that a Corbyn government, which ensures we stay in the customs union in some form, or a customs union in some form, is better than a Tory government, which is out of all of it.
Yes, if we assume that Labour's vote didn't max out in 2017, and I assume it didn't, actually. I think there are more votes Labour could get. Those votes, as Stephen Bush has written, you'd have thought would come from Remain voting Tories. And so a mixture of Labour's present vote plus those Remain Tories plus those who want time for, who think it's time for a change, could be enough for Labour to get over the threshold it needs for a majority government.
It's possible. I don't think it's very likely, though. I think Labour are doing the sensible thing and playing that game. I just don't think it's necessarily going to be that successful. Based on where we are currently and the current state of play, that I think Labour's vote has been maxed out, I think it's going to take an awful lot to increase the swing further.
Okay. Just as Theresa May's position always seems to be kind of half a step forward, two steps back, it feels a bit like that with Corbyn on Brexit as well. So Corbyn was at the Scottish Labour conference on Friday. In the speech, he says, we can't be held back from inside or outside the EU from investing in industry. And you think, well, no, of course not, because Germany can invest in industry in the EU. Mm-hmm. We can do it too. He talks about the fact that about state aid and wanting to stop privatising outsourcing, which again, you can do inside the EU. And then the really kind of controversial bit, I suppose, of the speech is that he talks about, I will quote this in full because I think it's important, is from preventing employers being able to import cheap agency labour to undercut existing pay and conditions in the name of free market orthodoxy. Now, Ed Miliband got a lot of crap thrown at him and everyone went absolutely ballistic when he put out a mug that said controls on immigration on it. And those same people who were really critical of Ed Miliband for that are basically staying silent when Jeremy Corbyn says that immigrants are driving down wages when there's no evidence that that is happening.
Yeah, it is absolutely fascinating to a degree the double think that's happening. I don't think it's necessarily unusual, though. I think this is to a certain extent the standard. My side has said something, therefore it must be the good thing. The other side has said something, it must be a bad thing. Only in this instance, what we're looking at here is the left versus the centre-left. Accusing the centre-left of betrayal is the standard thing that the left has done for decades. The control on immigration mugs, as a conduit for that, was just, you know, a continuation of that trend. What I do think is important to note here, though, is that whenever we talk about kind of people who are defending Corbyn, and we bring up these kind of points of hypocrisy, it's important to just focus on the fact that an awful lot of Corbyn's core support and base comes from Momentum. And Momentum as an organisation itself is made up of a lot of people who weren't engaged with the Labour Party back under Ed Miliband's leadership. So when we are kind of making these kind of criticisms, and it is legitimate, you know, you will absolutely be able to find people from the Campaign Action Group and things like that within Labour who have probably made those points. But it's important not to lump the entirety of Momentum's membership with that.
Absolutely. And I think I'm thinking more really about people like Diane Abbott and Owen Jones, who were very, very critical in speech and in print about this, and yet have said nothing.
Well, there was an interesting bit of analysis on Diane Abbott's, actually. She gave a speech the other day after mm-hmm. Corbyn's speech. She rushed through the section of her speech, which was talking about the damages that immigration could do on wages. It was not delivered in a way that was particularly convincing compared to other parts of the script. It was in there because that was the party line,
mm-hmm.
but it was not something necessarily that she agreed with. So I suspect there is some internal dialogue happening on this. And this is a classic example, perhaps, of the Labour leadership team trying to triangulate on the issue, where they feel that, again, to try and pick up, either to secure some of the anti-immigration Labour vote and stop it drifting off to the Tories, or to try and pick up a few stragglers on the Tory side of the fence, they feel that it's worth actually focusing on this as an issue.
It's interesting because when you compare it to the Ed Miliband position, and again, Ed Miliband was trying to triangulate on immigration, but he did it in a slightly different way, I think, because the Miliband position was almost people, when you say you're concerned about immigration, you're not really concerned about immigration, you're concerned about wages, and therefore we're going to crack down on people who pay agency workers less than the minimum wage. And that was the Miliband position. Now, in a way, it's a bit disingenuous, because a lot of the time when people say they are against immigration, they are literally against immigration. It's not that it's a proxy for something else. But it's interesting that here, Corbyn doesn't mention, he doesn't talk about it being immigrant workers being paid less than the minimum wage. He almost talks about the fact that because of free market orthodoxy, because we've got free movement of labour, that is driving down wages. And generally, that's not really very true.
No, it isn't true. There's numerous studies which have been done which basically shows that. I think, again, it really does just boil down to the fact that this is politically expedient. Corbyn's got enough political capital with his support base that he can get away with it. It's the exact same reason he's been able to get away with being not a full-on Remainer, because he's got left-wing credentials on a number of other issues. People are more willing to look the other way for the few areas where, you know, maybe he isn't whiter than white. And as time is going on, we're identifying more and more issues, either whether he just genuinely isn't as left-wing and as you know, some people might want, such as on Europe, or where just realpolitik just means, you know, he can't just strike up that purist policy position, which he would otherwise have done.
And it's that realpolitik which I think actually makes Corbyn's leadership very, very interesting, in that I think he's more strategic than he's often given credit for. And certainly there's no way when he won in 2015 that I would assume that he'd be triangulating to this extent. And it is maybe a sign that his team is much better at this approaching politics, certainly, than it was for about the first 18 months of his leadership.
Yeah, but I think the issue with this boils down to who is actually doing that triangulation. Is it Jeremy Corbyn? I don't think it is. I think it's John McDonnell.
Our theme tune is Plucky Good Times by Dave Depper, and James Cram designed our logo. My Twitter handle is PaperbackWriter.
Mine is @CentreRadical.
Check out our website, notenoughchampagne.com, and our Facebook page, facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. Happy plotting, everyone.